power personalities of the 20th century. What intrigues me about Ravarn Cutler is twofold. First of all, you've got that gaping hole in the 20th century, the great tragedy of the Holocaust. And the way it affects Torah giants is very, very dramatic. You've got very few people that have two acts in their lives and are as influential in pre-Shoah Europe as they are in post-Shoah Western civilization. You've got these great people who live in the first part of the 20th century. Interestingly enough, and I've told my shir this very often, you've got a lot of early deaths. A lot of gedolim die prematurely in the 20th century. Mayor Shapiro, and if people that die, I was like wondering, was HaKadosh Baruch Hu taking people away early to spare them the horrors of the Holocaust? But you've got people who are active and leading the great Torah world of pre-war Europe. And many of them, sadly, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yikom Damehem, perished in the Holocaust. Some of them escape. And they're not major, major impactors in post-war. They escape. They form have yeshiva here or there, but they don't really shape the Torah world. And they can, because they're of a different place. They have a different mindset. Not just the tragedy of the Shoah. It's just they've got people who learned in Europe, but didn't really impact or influence the European Torah structure. Then all of a sudden, post-war, they rise to prominence. And I use Rabbi Soloveitchik as the paradigm. Everyone knew who Rabbi Soloveitchik was in Europe, but he didn't make any major shifts in the European Torah world. It was Talmud Chacham. And all of a sudden, he's in America, more or less around post-World War II, and then he creates this whole framework of Yeshiva University and Torah Amada. Here's a person, Ravarn Cutler, who was as influential in pre-war Europe as he was in post-war, and he didn't really shift, which makes him so intriguing, because he ended up impacting America and Western Torah world in the same way, more or less, that he was slated to impact the pre-war Europe, which is an amazing feat on many fronts. The second thing which intrigues me is, and this is going to sound ironic, and I don't want this year to become that, but you'd be surprised to find how many parallels there are between what Ravarn Cutler did in Lakewood and what Rav Yehuda Amital did in the room you're sitting in. And I'll try to highlight one or two. You won't necessarily associate Gush with Lakewood, but you'd be surprised how similar they are in many respects. So let's start from the beginning. Who was he? Where was he born? What places? So he was born in 1892, born in Slobodka, learns in Slobodka, And he's already known, we've talked a lot about Slobodka, as the rising star in Slobodka. In fact, the Slobodka Yeshiva is being visited, Kovno, which is the town nearby Slobodka, is being visited by the two great Gedolim of their day. Two great older Gedolim were Rabbi Soloveitchik, Chaim Soloveitchik, and Rabbeinu Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, the Meshech Chachma. They're coming for a visit to see the up-and-coming farm team, these younger Talmidei Chachamim. So who do they send out? Who does the Saba of Slobodka send out as one of this party to greet Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rav Meir Simcha? They send out Ravarn Cutler. And it's just electric. They don't know what to the Saba of Slobodka says, I would have built the yeshiva of Slobodka just for this one Talmud. Would have enough this one Talmud. Reb Chaim says, I've never met someone like him in 40 years. For Reb Chaim to say that, that's pretty dramatic. And Rabbeinu Meir Simcha Cohen says, listen to this language, this is the next Rabbi Kiveva. That would be like saying you're the next Vilna Gaon. This is the next Rabbi Kiveger. Rabbi Kiveger becomes a terminology for the greatest gadol of his period. So this is clearly someone that everyone's noticing at a very young age is going to be the rising star of European Torah Jewry. Then he moves in 1911. Please take a seat, guys. In 1911, he moves from the Slobodka Yeshiva. Let's sit in the back, guys. He moves from the Slobodka Yeshiva to a yeshiva in Slusk. Now, that may not sound that familiar to you, but the head of the yeshiva in Slusk is none other than Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, whose daughter, Rav Aaron Cutler, marries. So now he's pedigreed, he's part of the inner circle of the yeshiva of Slusk. Keep in mind, Rav Amital marries Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer's granddaughter. So they're actually related through marriage. So in 1911, he moves from Slobodka to Slusk. 1914, gets married. One of the leaders of the yeshiva, then he becomes the leader of the yeshiva, and then in 1921 he moves to a yeshiva called Kletsk, and he becomes Kletsk, the Rosh Yeshiva of Kletsk, from 1921 until more or less the yeshiva had to close in World War II. And you're generally finding both in World War I and World War II, yeshivos fling easterly. That's the general pattern. Because of all the war fronts, so generally yeshivas are always relocating every couple of years to move out of harm's way, deeper and deeper into Eastern Europe, deeper and deeper into White Russia, just to get out of the way of the wars and the conflagrations. And during the 1920s, the Kletsk yeshiva was one of the top yeshivas in Europe. It was the second largest yeshiva, only Mir had more students. So this is not just a small town yeshiva. Rabbi Zalman Meltzer leaves Kletsk in 1925. They move together from Slutsk to Kletsk, and then in 1925 he becomes the head until around 1941 when the yeshiva basically has to disband because of World War II. But you're already seeing in his experience in the 20s and 30s in Europe the seeds for how he would change the Torah world when he moves to America. Because he's not just a Rosh Yeshiva, but he's creating organizational structures at which he lies at the helm, at which he's directing. So one of the organizational structures is he goes on one of the most major and well-known fundraising trips. Remember, fundraising trips in those days weren't getting on an LL plane, landing for a weekend, having a few dinners, and getting back. He went to America for 11 months to raise money for the yeshiva. He goes to Europe in 1933 to the United Kingdom. 1936 he goes to America. And he's already talking about, at that point, and this is very prescient, he's already talking about a word that Americans have never heard. It's completely foreign to Americans, and he's talking about building one of those in America. It's a word that will forever be associated with Lakewood. It's called a kolel. And it boggles the imagination. A kolel? 95% of Americans aren't religious. They're losing their orthodoxy. Let's just work on keeping basic tenets of faith and basic commandments intact. We're bleeding. We're hemorrhaging Orthodox Jews. And you're talking about a dedicated academy to study this ancient Torah. Let's just hope they'll keep Shabbos. It was obscene. It was absolutely preposterous. But he's talking about one day we'll build kolels here. In 1924, he organizes something called Vad HaYeshivos to organize all the yeshivos together. Very revolutionary concept. I don't know if it ever existed. We're part of something called the Igud Yeshivos Hezder. There are about 80 or 5 or so Hezder yeshivos. So all the Hezder yeshivos have one common body with which we make joint decisions, called the Igud Yeshivos Hezder. Go back 400 years in history, who thought of organizing yeshivos? This is the great age of organization, the labor unions, power amongst the many, creating fraternity, solidarity. So he creates the Vad HaYeshivos. He's joined by the elderly statesmen. The elderly Talmidei Chachamim of his day are the Chafetz Chaim, Rebbe Chanan. But he's the executive arm. He's the one that runs this organization. He's also instrumental in building the Agudah in Europe, which isn't a string of yeshivas, but just a communal organization. Anyway, World War II breaks out. He flees to Japan. He is rescued by the Vad Hatzalah. You all know what the Vad Hatzalah is. This was primarily an American organization tasked with trying to, through various interventions, many of them financial, try to rescue as many Jews as possible. It is an organization that recently has come under a lot of scrutiny because there certainly was preferential treatment showed to Gedolim. They didn't just pay per head. They paid a lot of money for Gedolim, and a lot of people questioned the morality and ethics, and that's not today's share, but you just know when people say Vad Hatzalah, a lot of very interesting stories and research are associated with it. The Vad Hatzalah, there are many Vad Hatzalahs, but the United States Vad Hatzalah was the largest, so he's redeemed. He then comes to America, 1942, 43, and he's in Borough Park, he's living as a big gadol. He gives shiur in a small yeshiva there called Torah V'Daz, not really that popular yet. Then all of a sudden, the second stage of his career begins. And this is an American, this is a European who's in his 50s or 60s, and doesn't speak English that well, and all of a sudden, he's about to change the United States of America, and by extension. And he says, and this is really his statement that I think has changed the yeshiva world. Okay? The modern world is alien to Torah. Torah is vulnerable. If we want to rebuild Torah, here's the word, we have to be separate. Now, separate means geographically. The logical place to build the yeshiva would have been New York City. That's where most of the Jews lived. He finds a sleepy little southern New Jersey beach town called Lakewood, where barely anyone lived, let alone Jews. But his strategy is, Torah has to be protected from Maderi. It is the antithesis of Rav Soloveitchik. The complete antithesis. Torah has to be protected and insulated, and therefore we can't build the yeshiva in New York. There'll be too many distractions, too much conversation. Let's move it out. Which, by the way, was the model which was followed in Israel. What became the greatest and biggest post-war yeshiva in Israel? It recreated a yeshiva in Europe, but it's become the largest Panevish. Where would you think of building Panevish? In Shalai, Eretz Kodesh. Somehow there's too much secularism. There's too much secular discussion. Let's move it to Bnei Brak, which then was nothing. Move it out. And it also resembles another great yeshiva that was built in that style. And you're sitting in it. This place wouldn't be what it is if it were in Yerushalayim. There's too much conversation, too much people looking over your shoulder. What are they doing in Gush? What are they doing in... What is Rav Amital doing? What's this new yeshiva he's building? What's Rav Lichtenstein here? Distance sometimes matters. So let's say you go to a sleepy little West Bank settlement no one knows about. They're scared out of their wits to travel there. And all of a sudden you have the freedom to build a Torah world without having to, I don't want to say cowtail, but conform and deal with all the pressure surrounding you. It's another similarity. Anyone want to take a guess how many people learned in Lakewood when it was established in 1943? How many boys were in Lakewood? In Klutzk Yeshiva, now called Lakewood. Well, let's go backwards. Today there are 6,000 people living in Lakewood. Learning in Lakewood, excuse me. I'll talk about living in Lakewood in a moment. How many boys do you think you started the yeshiva with? 15. 1-5. 1962, when he dies, there were 250. So it goes from 15 in 1943 to 250 in 1962 to 6,000 plus in 2016. And it becomes the yeshiva of Rosh Yeshivas. This is seen as the top, if not one of the top yeshivas, that trains the future leaders of the Torah world. People will go there to write Svarim. But what it also does, and I don't think he ever knew this or intended it, he couldn't have, it creates a whole new model for yeshiva. I remember I mentioned the Slobodka Yeshiva before. When they built the Slobodka Yeshiva, the heads of the yeshiva told the architect, build a big wall between the yeshiva and the town of Kovna. We don't want the Balabatim of Kovna negatively influencing the Bachrim of Slobodka. Now all of a sudden, a yeshiva is not just to be sequestered and insulated from reality, but it creates a new reality. Do you know how many Torah studying, halacha performing, deeply passionate religious Jews live in Lakewood around the yeshiva as part of this Lakewood community, not just people learning in yeshiva? I mentioned 6,000. Has anyone ever been to Lakewood? What'd you say? 70,000 people? 60,000? I mean, you're not talking about 4,000 or 5,000 people. Talking about an entire community pivoted on Torah. And kolim, and shuls, and batei medrash, and programs. Well, what does that remind you of? A yeshiva that has created a community around it. You're sitting. When you travel and you look at the mountains and look at Efrat, and you look at the Vei Daniel, and you look at El Azhar, it's a little different. Certainly the ideology is a little different. And I don't think there's many people involved in kolim learning, because our energies are more dissipated amongst many fronts, army and society and other. But essentially you're creating a model of a community that grows from a yeshiva, that grows as an outgrowth of a yeshiva. At a certain point you reach synergy, in which is no longer growing from the yeshiva, people just moving independently. I don't think everyone in Lakewood today learns in Lakewood, but it reached the point of synergy, the tipping point, where it wasn't directly fueled by it. And this is all done by a person who's a European who barely spoke English when he came over. I want to read a quote for you, which always stuck with me. He says, "For myself, I wouldn't have come, only to help save, with your assistance, American Yidden, the centuries-old Torah of Europe." He had this sense that he was spared from the Holocaust for a mission. Many Holocaust survivors walked away from the Holocaust with guilt and shame. Why was I spared and others weren't? Which is natural. For him, he walked away with a sense of mission. Again, I don't want this to become me constantly quoting Rav Amital, but we picked it up from Rav Amital as well. I have to build a new model of a yeshiva. I have to build... I want you to sense the parody and what's going on in Lakewood in 1943 and what happened here in Israel 20, 30 years later. It's a different ideology, slightly different. It's not just slightly different. He was a very staunch person. There are a few clips you want to go on YouTube, and the way he spoke, you could even tell how staunch he was. Bang the desk. He's an older man. He'd sit there and repeat the statement again and again, and it's mesmerizing to watch. He'd tell him the story that in Europe, some of his Talmidim wanted to come ask his permission or his guidance about making Aliyah, not Nefesh B'Nefesh flag waivers, just to move to Israel. And they had already received permission and endorsement from the greats, or Chaim and some of the others. He was staunchly opposed. Don't go to Israel. Too much secularism there. You'll lose your identity. The second platform that he was staunchly opposed to, secular education. He wouldn't admit any secular education, wouldn't allow the boys to go to college at all. That's changing today in terms of getting an education, not necessarily going to college, but staunchly opposed to it. Again, he felt the Torah to be protected and regenerated. Remember that word I used before, separate? So the next time you see a yeshiva bachur who's wearing a white shirt and black pants, and it doesn't make sense to you, why does dress make a difference? The answer is, Torah has to be separated and identified. And there's going to be a uniform for people that are B'nai Torah and Torah studies. You don't just study Torah and then mix and behave amongst the masses. You study Torah and you ID yourself as a Ben Torah. And the Ben Torah's uniform, in their perspective, has now become a white shirt and black pants. Separate language. You ever heard people speak Yeshivish? Taka and Mamash and Givaldik and words they're not even comfortable with. It's not their Mamalashan. But if you're really separate and you live in a separate place and you dress separately, then you want to have a separate language to demarcate and to say that you're protecting your Torah and its identity. Just understand it. I understand that sometimes the differences may seem large and not that great. You know how many times Rav Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, demanded that no boy could remain in this yeshiva while he's taking college courses? Big Torah Mada proponent. If you want to take college courses, big support of college. When you finish leaving yeshiva, when you're involved in Torah, you're immersed in Torah. He didn't want to dilute or water down the Torah experience in the yeshiva. Finish your learning, then go to college, depending on what timing and needs and opportunities. Interestingly enough, because we just came from Chabad, it was part of our conversation, he came from Svat, he was also, was a little bit uncomfortable with Chabad. This is before the messianic tendencies emerged, but just, I'm not going to elaborate on this, but he certainly is associated with that. Some of the early opposition to some of the Chabad approaches. And again, this is before the messianic issue emerged in the early 90s. But what's also interesting about him is, okay, so now I've painted a picture of a gadol who recreates the yeshiva, the Kletzk yeshiva, thousands of people, tens of thousands of B'nai Torah, writing svarim. Do you know that he didn't write any svarim, or hardly any svarim? After his death, they had to actually put together an organization called Mishnah Sirvarim to Paskin, to write his Torah over. Paskin was said. He was just so busy running the yeshiva, and extending his yeshiva through two important organizations that you should know about. And that's why I see the parallels between his pre-war experience and his post-war experience. In pre-war experience, he was a great Talmud Chacham learning in yeshiva training Rabbanim, but he was also involved in the Aguda, he was also involved in the Vada yeshivas. And in post-war Europe, he forms two very important organizations. One is called Chinuch Atzmai. In the early 50s, all the sectors in Israel organized and institutionalized basically into two. Before 1952-53, we've got all these independent branches of education. Now there are two branches of education. Mamlachti, which is essentially public school, and Mamlachti Dati, which is national religious school. Government run, but for the religious people. What about if I'm a Haredi? I still don't want to go to public school, and I don't want to go to national religious schools. It's not my ideology. So the third branch becomes Chinuch Atzmai. I don't know the numbers, but it must be 80, 90,000 children. It's important. He becomes the organizer and the initiator, the founder of Chinuch Atzmai. Rabbi Ryan, I'm sure you took your Chinuch Atzmai pushka as I did, because we were both brought up in Haredi backgrounds, and we'd be given the pushkas, or a Surah Haredi. I'd be given a pushka every Pesach, and I'd go around. See, my leverage was that I lived in most of my friends lived in Jewish neighborhoods. But I lived in a very Christian neighborhood. And boy, did they give money. I always won the prize. There's little adding machines. I always brought home the prize because I went from door to door and I collected for Chinuch Atzmai and I brought the pushka back. And I supported Jews in Israel, hungry Jews in Israel. The second organization, which you may have heard of, is, and this is going to sound very unLakewood-like, it's called Tara Masara. He founds Tara Masara. How can we create day schools across the wild, empty plains of the United States? Detroiters, right? Tara Masara. How can we create Tara? Not to teach them Tosfos and the Rashba and the Ramban. He's not recreating Lakewood. Teach them Shabbos candles. How to make challah. How to make Kiddush. Purim's coming. What's Purim? Another quote of his. Another favorite quote. The great benefit the yeshiva brings to Klal Yisrael accrues to the entire nation, even to those who have distanced themselves from the Torah's way. People are no longer from. For the Torah and its scholars, the heart of the nation. And that's my message to you guys. It's about attitude, not about expression. We're in a yeshiva in which the boys will close their svarim after 2 years and serve in the army because we translate national consciousness, worrying about our people and friends and our brothers, into serving with them side by side, shoulder to shoulder in the army. That's our ideology, and if that strikes you and inspires you, join us. What about the yeshiva bachur learning in Bnei Brak? Don't look at his expression. Think about his attitude. If he's saying, I'm learning on behalf of Am Yisrael and the future advancement of our people and protection of our state, and I worry about my people and I worry about them and I respect soldiers and I respect state, and but my expression, I'm going to invest exclusively in Torah, that's just as legitimate. It may not be your form. It may not be your expression. And he was a microcosm, not just an attitude, but an expression. He wasn't building universities. He wasn't building the state of Israel as a national political institution. He builds a yeshiva that reshapes Torah learning, that has spread kollels across, I mean, now high school kids. It's funny. There's a high school program a lot of Americans go on, the NCSY kollel. When older people hear that, they don't know what to make of it. NCSY kollel? High school kids are getting married? Since when high school kids getting married? They're living in kollel. His kollel was always... essentially, Ravaron Cutler is responsible for the NCSY kollel. Because he makes kollel so popular that it becomes a catchword for people that are spending time learning. Because he places kollels all across America, all across the world. The Lakewood kollel, the Lakewood kollel. So kollel, which is typically associated with a way to support young men who want to learn a little while they're in the early stage of their marriage, kollel becomes a synonym with serious learning. High school kollels. Kindergarten kollels. It's a kollel. He's responsible for it. But he's not just interested in teaching high-level Torah in Lakewood. He also founds Tara Masara. He also supports institutions for first graders and second graders across Israel, not just for teaching a Shaf or teaching a Tosfos. And I don't know that there's a person in post-war Orthodox Jewry, certainly in the Torah world, who is as influential. Probably, on anyone's guess, would be in terms of organizationally, Bira Soloveitchik, in Western civilization. I'm not talking about in Israel. It was Soloveitchik and Ravaron Cutler. Rav Moshe Feinstein was supposed to take a door, but he never created institutions. People asked him a lot of shalos, but he was never associated with a larger movement beyond himself. And just to show you how not to get caught in ideology and stigmas, when Rav Isaac Herzog passed away, who was Rav Isaac Herzog? First?
Chief Rabbi.
Rav Aaron Cutler, who had discouraged his Talmidim from moving to Israel, gave a beautiful husband for him. So it wasn't about people or views, it was just we're creating a world. And I guess the other message to take away is sometimes you have to be a staunch adherent to your position, even when it flies in the face of convention. No one would have thought in their wildest dreams in 1943 that there'd be 6,000 people learning. It was a joke. Learning Torah in America? He was very staunch. He was very inflexible. He was very intransigent. We're going to do this and we're not going to cave. We're not going to compromise. No college. I'm sure many times people offered him money if he'd introduced college studies. This is Torah and Torah is eternal. And if you serve Torah, you'll succeed. Have a great day, everyone. Okay, very good. You just made it, or is it?
No.